Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest today is Peter Orner, and he's been on before. He's one of my favorite writers, but also a sublime person. I think he's just a remarkable character who has been reading and writing with an intensity that's so deep and so beautiful that this new book, Maggie Brown and Others, I would say redefines the very idea of what a collection of short stories is. Once again, it's called Maggie Brown and Others. It's by my guest, Peter Orner. It's published by Little Brown, and it's a collection of, I don't know what to call them, 44 short stories, sequences, 43 short stories and a novella, 43 short stories plus a novella that's made up of around 18 short stories. You know how when I maybe talk about something as being experimental or new, that these are code words for difficult? These are not code words for difficult in the case of Maggie Brown and Others. What it is that Peter seems to be asking, how does life tell us stories, and how do we tell the stories life tells us? And life tells us its stories over and over and over again. Every day we wake up and we hear versions of the same story. And so what he's done is take this set of characters to whom the same things happen. Maybe they live on the West Coast at the beginning of the book. Peter was writing these stories, I think, when he lived on the West Coast. Then there are stories that take place in Fall River, where Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. But this is not the Fall River of Lizzie Borden. It's the Fall River of Peter's family, and a place where Jews don't belong, where Jews have nevertheless stayed on. So what is it with you and the Jews, Peter?
My family, every time they read one of my books, they're like, "What? When did you become so Jewish?" You know, because I listened to everyone telling me stories my whole life, you know, and I, you know, you said that you wake up in the morning and there's a story in the morning and there's a story in the afternoon, and it's usually a story that you've heard before. And I think I've just spent my whole life collecting. And I think in the case of Fall River, my mother was born there and my grandparents lived there their entire lives, rarely leaving. And I became fascinated by this city that still gives me stories, and I appreciate it.
Your very first book, The Esther Stories, was published, nearly won an award, and then went on to be republished and republished and republished again, as if it had won awards. In the most recent republication of the Esther Stories, the one I have in front of me, Marilyn Robinson writes the introduction. And Beattie would tell me about the Esther Stories. All the writers I liked would say, "Have you read the Esther Stories?" Just amazing. And there are characters in this new book, Maggie Brown and Others, who are drawn from the Esther Stories. So tell me, do you have a way of describing this? What is this? This is a book that collects, reshuffles, reconceives everything you've ever done, yeah?
Can I interrupt and say it's wonderful to be back with you here? Is that okay?
It's wonderful to have you, of course.
But Esther Stories has a section in it called Fall River Marriage that about Walt and Sarah Kaplan's marriage, and I basically wanted to tell that story again. And I feel like, you know, 18 years later or so, I feel like when a story is told, for me, it's not over. I think what I've come to is accept that. I used to feel guilty about it. I used to feel as if I lacked imagination, and I do lack imagination, but I feel like I've embraced that lack of imagination, and the idea that I can tell a story again in a different way allows me to revisit something in a totally different, in maybe more intense way or a different angle on it. You know, so a story that's told isn't exhausted.
Well, it's so great, Peter, because sometimes you take the DNA of one character and place it in another character, so you see what another character would be like if they were given a different set of genes. And since I've come to know these people in your stories so well, and the people who read your stories like to say things like, he not only makes characters, he gives them souls. A beautiful thing to have said about you. You're experimenting with what people are like when you put them into stories. They're altered by being in a story.
I think that's true. And I think I think the losses that people carry, you know, we all carry. There's more in common with those losses than there is not. And I feel like, so I like to write across generation, you know, and you know, old characters, young characters, whoever they are, they're carrying the same kind of grief, you know, and hopefully humor too, you know. And so I feel like I want characters, especially across generation, to speak to each other in that way, like that they can obviously have a great deal in common with their life experience.
His last book was a book of nonfiction. It was called Am I Alone Here? Notes on Living to Read and Reading to Live. Your father had died, and you decided that you were having a hard time with fiction. So you started to write little selections about the books you loved.
Yeah.
And the books you loved were events in your life like any other event, like your father's death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How could a book that you love and love powerfully not be as important as almost any other thing?
Right.
And so this new book, Maggie Brown and Others, by my guest Peter Orner, has not only a dedication, do I have it correct, to his children, but to one of his writing teachers, James Allen McPherson, as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, McPherson was the first person of color to win a Pulitzer Prize. It's almost shocking to think so.
I think Gwendolyn Brooks had won earlier for poetry, but he was the first fiction writer, I believe, to win that particular prize, and it was for Elbow Room. James Allen McPherson was my teacher at the University of Iowa, and he was a very unique writer and a very unique individual. And he, one of the things that I think I got from him most of all was he gave me license to move into other people's heads and be compassionate towards them. He taught a class once. It was about law and literature, and he had gone to law school. He'd been to Harvard in the 60s, and he taught a class about Richard Jewell. He was the guy who was accused of being the Atlanta bomber.
Oh my!
He was a security guard at the Atlanta Olympics, and he was a guy who lived with his mother. He was a bit of a sad sack, and the theory of the FBI was that he planted the bomb in order to be a hero. It turned out he was just a hero. And McPherson was fascinated by this particular story, that somebody could be so selfless and be sort of accused of being not. It speaks to what I learned from him, whereas you can't look at somebody and sum them up. You can't do it. And to know somebody, you've got to go deep. And so for me, that was the greatest gift of all.
McPherson won the Pulitzer in 1978. I gave a talk there at Iowa, and my talks are as much, they're like my show. They're about how much I like things, how much I like things and couldn't live without them.
Right.
People were coming up and, hugging me, and I seem to compel these behaviors. I don't mean to, but I do. McPherson had already thanked me and shook my hand, but he saw people, Ethan Kanan and James Galvin, hugging me. And he came up to me and he said, "Can I hug you? I want to hug you too." I said, "Well, of course you can hug me." And then when he gave me a hug, he said, "It's been so long since I've heard anyone talk about reading and writing in terms of love, in terms of loving to do it and needing it to stay alive, that I just want to thank you because it's the way I think about it too." And if you go to read Peter Orner, I guess you can tell he was taught by such a man, because love and pain and the whole damn thing, I think there's a book by that title, are so much a part of what Peter Orner does. Now, as it happens, a movie actress named Ruth Roman somehow came to know Peter's parents. This was a woman who was in Strangers on a Train. Uh-huh. She was in Hitchcock movies. She was one of those, we don't really have them, noble supporting character actresses.
Yes.
She was spectacularly good. And Peter took the occasion to write about her and the feeling she generated in one of the stories in his new book.
This is called Miami Beach, 1961. My parents are in a bar. My mother is 20. My father is 27. Some local barfly starts something up with a naval officer in a gleaming white uniform. My father was in the Army during the Korean War, though he never left the state of Missouri. He loathed every minute of it. Even so, there was something about the brilliance of the officer's uniform that captivated my father. Maybe it was the man's Napoleonic epaulets, his beautiful golden shoulders. It also stands to reason that my father had had more than a few drinks by that point. Whatever it was, my father got up from the table he was sharing with my mother and clocked the barfly right off his stool. Mayhem ensues, my mother always says, like in a Western. Tables overturned, chairs broken over heads. You wouldn't think, my mother would say, that you really can break a chair over someone's head, but you can. I saw it in person. The officer and his men whisk the newlyweds to safety out in the street. Valiant father. Beautiful mother. Yellow sundress, wide belt with a silver buckle. The officer invites the two of them for a nightcap on the ship, and it's on that boat, in the officer's mess, that my parents meet the movie star Ruth Roman, a member of the officer's party. She must have been at least 15 years older than my mother at the time, but still glamorous in a cavalier sort of way. She called everybody, even the ship's cat, darling, and she thought my young father should act. Talk about stealing the show. Does he always break into scenes like that? She asked my mother. And he wasn't even in the credits. Ruth Roman drunk, happily drunk. They were all happily drunk. And she began to regale my parents with stories of Hollywood, where everybody behaved like cads and everybody, especially the merry ones, went home lonely. And my parents ate it up. Their honeymoon had a headline. Whatever happened to the naval officer that lost Gatsby in his white uniform, who knows? Maybe Ruth Roman married him for a while.
Peter Orner allowing Ruth Roman a lovely supporting role
yes.
in the story of his parents' marriage. Everywhere you look, there are details from the stories you want to tell left over to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike most of what I would call experimental writing, as I say, it's so readable. Not just so readable, it becomes unforgettable because some of the things that happen to one set of characters happen again to another set of characters, mm-hmm. but they behave differently.
Right.
I haven't seen this in a book of short stories before. Does it come from anywhere you can think of, Peter?
You know, I'm pretty out, you know, out front about my influences, McPherson being one, Gina Berielt, Isaac Babel. You know, Isaac Babel taught me that cycles of stories could work together, you know, and so I'm very influenced by Red Cavalry, the Odessa stories, how those stories kind of interact together. But I guess I will say that when I was putting this together, I was somewhat jealous of novelists who can have like a baggy novel and have all sorts of stuff in it and all sorts of characters. And I thought, like, why does a story collection have to be so tight? Why can't it be a little bit sprawling? For me, I mean, I'm not a big sprawler on the page. My stuff tends to be tight. But I wanted to have a gallery of characters. And I wanted to have, like I said, characters talking across generation. I wanted to have a story of a very unhappy marriage for various reasons. And I wanted to have a story of a counterpoint. I wanted to have a story, to tell it. I think a happy marriage is not uninteresting. And I wanted to end the book with a nod towards the possibility of a happy marriage. So, things like that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Peter Orner about his new book, Maggie Brown and Others. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And I'm talking with Peter Orner about his new book, Maggie Brown and Others. 44 sometimes interlocking, sometimes gem-like stories, sometimes just anecdotes, sometimes a set of factoids that you might find in a almanac about people whose lives are at different points of inflecting one another. They know each other, and you know them too. As you read, I don't know about you, but I felt my parents, their marriage must have been sort of like this. And yeah, they pushed two single beds together. In their case, they never pushed them apart. But in the case of the happy marriage, they pushed them apart every day, I think, to make the bed, and then pushed them together at night to sleep together. It's a beautiful story of the story of what a couple can be.
Yeah, I think it was also the time. I mean, I think, you know, your bedroom in the 50s, you know, it had two single beds. But I always wondered, again, because my grandparents, who these stories are based on, did have a happy marriage, at least far as I could see. So I knew they had to push those beds together because they were two big people and there was no way they were going to fit in a single bed. So they needed the two beds. So I figured, I just imagined them, and at night when things are getting a little, you know, happy, I thought they would have had to literally get out of bed and push the beds together. And I thought, what a wonderful notion.
There's another marriage in which one of the partners is, in fact, becoming crazy, losing her mind in the course of the marriage. She's not losing her mind because she's mean or bad or because she wants to. She's losing her mind because that's one of the things that happened to a mind. And it's a story you've told before, and it's a very painful story. What led you to retell it?
When you tell a story, in this case, I've told it, you know, and actually in nonfiction to an extent. I think in this particular case, nonfiction wasn't enough. I had to go back to fiction to deal with it. And I think, again, a story that you feel like you're done with, especially one that is personal, especially one that is painful, can't ever be over. You know, I don't think we get over stuff. And so it's not a story I'm ever going to be done with. And I felt like this particular couple in the book dealing with a, you know, mental illness in a way that I tried to be honest and compassionate. As you say, it isn't anyone's fault. When you're in the heart of it, in the thick of it, in the throes of it, anybody will tell you, you know, there's fault all around, you know. And so I wanted to show what it's like for two people to go through this kind of hell together. And it, again, not always be hell. I mean, there are moments in that particular sequence of stories where there are moments of lightness, as there always are. And I feel like if we only go into the darkness without acknowledging the light, we're not really explaining how things truly are experienced by people, you know, especially in that kind of situation. So I guess the answer would be, is why did I do it? I just felt like I had to go back into that particular story and try and work it out through another set of stories to see if I could get some answers, but I'm not done with it.
In that final sequence, which is a novella, we learn that the husband who has died, his best friend probably, is in love with the husband Walter's wife. Excuse me. Not just in love with the husband Walter's life, but with the husband Walter's wife.
Yes. Both.
Both, exactly. Yes, yes. And he's
in love with the two of them, as our friends are, our best friends are, aren't they?
Yeah. You know? And, you know, people are envious because they seem happy.
Right.
They may not have anything. They don't have money.
Right.
They don't have a lot of things that are thought to be constituent properties of happiness, but they are unquestionably happy. And so this best friend can't come to the funeral. He's one of the casket bearers,
but
he can't make himself get out of bed.
Right.
And he says to the wife, who was in love with him, who knows he loves her, where were you? And he said, I stopped in Constantinople. On the way here, I had to stop off in hell. And it's so amazing. You see, these stories are full of everything and also full of nothing. You know, it's a very nice thing. These stories don't have beginnings, middles, and ends, and they don't come to an end. They keep throwing significant details.
You know, you're a pallbearer for your best friend, and that seems like a ritual that you must go through as an ending point. But I felt like Alf Dolinsky, only because you just said this, but Alf Dolinsky didn't want it to end. So he's like, you know what? I'm not going to show up for my duty as pallbearer, which is a horribly offensive thing.
The rabbi is very angry.
the rabbi says it's never happened that you know, a pallbearer has not shown up for duty. And Alf's like, you know, I'm out here mourning him for real, you know.
And the rabbi says, what do you think? You're the only one. And what about his wife? What about his children? Who do you think you are?
Right.
And the question, who do you think you are? Is, I think, a real question in Peter Orner's stories, because these characters are one another, too. They're not just best friends. They have taken turns being in the barrel, being the recipient of the pain that now is being passed on to the next.
Right.
And it's what makes these stories, well, it's why there are 44 of them, you know, because you can't stop.
I can't stop. And you know, maybe, you know, I feel like I, you know, it's a wonderful thing about being a story writer. For me, I got stories everywhere, and I don't have to be locked in to a story that I have to, you know. I write novels. I like to write novels, but what I truly love is the fact that I can go down the street and there can be a story there and a story there, and a story at the guy at the food truck outside KCRW, and today he decided to have something else for lunch. Why? Because he's upset about this. You know what I mean? It can go on and on. And I feel like it's a privilege to do what I'm able to do, because, I mean, who gets to do this? You know, so I'm lucky.
Well, it's very wonderful. Maggie Brown and others, by a writer I already like, is perhaps his best book. I've sent it to others. They agree with me. So it doesn't make me right, but it does make it an awfully good book. And Maggie Brown and Others is by my guest, Peter Orner. It's from Little Brown. And, well, thank you, Peter, for joining me again.
Oh, of course, Michael. You know, I can't tell you how much I love to be here. And can I go home and tell my family that you said I was a sublime person? I'm just going to quote that because they will howl with derision. But anyway, I'm going to take it to the bank right now. But thank you. You know, this is as everybody listening knows, this is the best show there is.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services, really. You can even hear it in Berlin. You can listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Sarah Rose Etter is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.